At Stanford University, the engineering library is getting rid of 85% of the books and magazines on its shelves. Librarians say that for engineers, paper is becoming obsolete. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
The periodical shelves at Stanford University's engineering library are almost empty. Helen Josephine, who runs the library, says in the last 5 years, they've moved online.
Those are available through their laptops. Some of them now have even mobile apps. So whenever the student needs to look up information online, it's available to them. They don't need to come to the library to use it.
Josephine says the students are also finding less use for many of the books that are in the library. For years, students would search the indexes of half a dozen volumes looking for the right formula, but not anymore.
Now, with books being digitized and available through full text search capabilities, they can find that formula quite easily.
While there are some basic formulas in engineering, it's a field that changes rapidly, particularly in specialties like bio and software engineering. Traditional textbooks have rarely been able to keep up. Engineering Dean Jim Plummer says his faculty is increasingly using online books.
So it allows our faculty to change examples, to put in new homework problems, to use new examples and lectures and things like that in almost a real-time way.
The engineering library has 80,000 books on the shelf, and like most libraries, it was acquiring more all the time. They were running out of room. The time had come to build a new library. Michael Keller is the head of Stanford's library system. Instead of creating more space for books, they decided to create less.
As the world turns, they're increasingly digital, and as the world turns, more of the items that appeared in physical form in previous decades and centuries are appearing in digital form.
When the new library opens, there will be 10,000 engineering books on the shelves, a drop of more than 85% from the old library. Keller says they determined which books to keep on the shelf by looking at how frequently a book was checked out. The vast majority of the collection hadn't been off the shelves in 5 years. Keller expects eventually there won't be any books on the shelf of the engineering library. For the moment, it's only the engineering library at Stanford that's cutting back on books, but Keller says he sees what's coming down the pike by looking at the current crop of students in every department.
They write their papers online, and they read articles online, and many, many, many of them read chapters and books online. I can see in this population of students with behaviors that clearly indicate where this is all going.
It is still rare among libraries around the country to get rid of such a large amount of books. But the signs are there that libraries are laying the groundwork for a different future. Libraries all over the country are spending more of their money on electronic resources and less on books, according to a survey by the Association of Research Libraries. Librarians like Helen Josephine are looking forward to spending less time with books and more time with people.
That's what we're so excited about, the idea of actually offering more services, offering more workshops, offering more one-on-one time with the students.
But universities that have tried to push students to use more digital books have also gotten some pushback. A group of disabled students sued Arizona State University over its use of the Kindle because it wasn't fully accessible to the visually impaired. Students at Stanford are mixed about the shift. Engineering student Sam Tai was checking out some old-fashioned paper books.
To read books on the screen is kind of tiring for me. So I sometimes like paper form. But if I can access books online, it's much more convenient for me. So I would actually prefer that as well.
And at least for now, Tai can have the option of both. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Now, better late than never. That's what you might say about the bookstore chain Borders. It's finally entering the e-book market. Yesterday, Borders announced it's launching an e-bookstore. Steve Carmody of Michigan Radio reports.
E-book or electronic book sales is the fastest growing segment of the retail book business. And up until now, Borders has been on the sidelines. But it now says it's partnering with Canadian e-book reader maker Kobo. E-book buyers can use Borders apps to read their selections on a variety of devices, including BlackBerries, iPhones, and iPads, but not with the popular Kindle. Borders CEO says the company's goal is to control 17% of e-book sales a year from today. As Borders struggles to sell books in retail stores, Michael Norris, a publishing trade analyst with Simba Information, says this could help.
With all of the hype and bluster about e-books, only about 9% of the U.S. adult population bought an e-book in 2009. And there's plenty of room for expansion.
Borders badly needs a boost in sales. The bookseller lost $33 million in the first quarter of the year, on top of losses last year. Only about 10% of books bought in the U.S. are sold by Borders, leaving it far behind Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For NPR News, I'm Steve Carmody in Ann Arbor.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is back here with me again. Hi, Lee. What's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, this week we began our look at the challenges of elder care. In our Tuesday parenting segment, we discussed juggling the needs of children and a spouse while caring for an elderly parent. And after that, we heard from lots of listeners, including Fred, who told us about his experience caring for his older relatives.
I don't have siblings. I don't have other relatives to rely on to take care of my elders. And until recently, I had three very old people. Now I have two. And they're always turning to me. And for many years, I have to put aside my love life, my work life, my finances can go into disarray because people have needs. And I respect them. They took care of me when I was a baby. I don't resent this work, but it's a real-life challenge.
Fred, let me say, you hang in there. We hear you. We appreciate you. And I want to thank all who wrote in with stories and suggestions about how to cover this obviously very important and emotional issue. So thank you for that. Yep. Lee, this week we also gave listeners a peek into Baltimore nightlife as we explored the subculture of house music. Our producers paid a visit to Club Paradox in the Charm City.
My name is Sonia Hillier. I've been coming for how many years? It's been at least probably 14 years, I'll say. And I just love house music.
And now as a compliment to that piece, Tell Me More contributor Lester Spence posted a blog on our website about his diehard love for house music. He wrote about how it got him through some difficult times, and that inspired readers to share their own stories. Here's a post from blogger Nancy. She writes, I was exposed to house by DJ Marcus Wyatt in L.A. at an after-hours called Does Your Mama Know? And she sure as hell didn't. House music spoke to the deepest pits of my soul. Having been fortunate enough to never get involved in drugs, I'm amazed that I can still stay up till 4 a.m. dancing. You know that's right.
That's crucial right there. All right. Thanks, Nancy.
Okay, Lee, any updates?
Yes, two things. Well, back in 2007, we covered an immigration rally in Los Angeles that turned violent after police ordered crowds to disperse. And right after the dust settled, we spoke to journalist Patricia Nazario. She was there on the scene covering the event for the local NPR member station, KPCC. Michelle, she told us how she was beaten repeatedly with a baton by members of the LAPD. Well, last Friday, a jury awarded Nazario $40,000 as part of almost $2 million in settlements to resolve lawsuits filed by others who were injured at the rally. And another thing we reported on this program was the controversy surrounding World Track star Caster Semenya of South Africa. Now, there were questions about the athlete's incredible speed and deep voice that led to a highly publicized investigation about her gender. And the ongoing debate and ambiguous results from gender testing sidelined her career, Michelle, for nearly a year. But this week, Semenya was cleared by the International Association of Athletics Federations to compete as a woman.
Wow. It's a very interesting story. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
The peace of an otherwise quiet summer weekend is often muddled by the sound of lawnmowers and leaf blowers. A couple of days ago in one major metropolitan city, an old-fashioned method of ground control provided an alternative soundtrack. Lisa Napoli has the story.
Morning rush hour in downtown Los Angeles. The heart of the business district is called Bunker Hill. A rare, misty rain grays the skies and dampens commuters. Precipitation isn't the only thing about this day in July that's unusual. In a steep hillside city park, right next to the world's shortest railway, 120 goats are about to be deployed.
Oh my gosh. They're so cute.
Nate Giddens was making his way to work in a nearby skyscraper when he spotted the livestock. Baby goats, mama goats, hungry goats. This natural landscaping crew had just been driven up from a farm in San Diego. Their assignment? Mowing down the unruly growth of brush on these 2.5 acres.
Well, I've never seen them used for this, ever. I think it's hysterical.
Community Redevelopment Agency of Los Angeles thinks it's smart, not to mention ecological. This is the third year in a row they've hired a herd to tend this unwieldy land. Johnny Gonzalez owns the goats. He says they get an undeserved bad rap.
Goats are great survivalists. They learn to survive on meager means, so people tend to think of them as doing something destructive. The goats allow the natural plants to take hold and pretty much do away with all the invasive weeds and grasses.
And entertain thousands of passers-by in the process. For these few days, Bunker Hill becomes a mix of fiercely urban and charmingly bucolic. Just ask Finney. He's one of several homeless men who sleep here. Today, he's right beside where the goats are working. He likes how they make the big, busy city more human.
They make everybody smile. Normally, people just, you know, come and go right here to the metro. And it's so nice to see people stopping and smiling and laughing. And it creates this kind of warmth, this unity, this kind of, you know, people talk about it, you know.
And it saves the city $3,000 over the environmentally unfriendly alternative of weed whackers and weed killers. But no matter how good a job they do, these goats won't have this particular gig forever. This site's slated to get developed into an office tower. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Napoli in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Cuba has long drilled for oil, but has never produced enough for itself. However, the U.S. Geological Survey estimates there may be up to 6 billion barrels of oil reserves offshore, enough to meet all of Cuba's needs and more. So far, Cuba's state-run oil company has been unable to tap them. A Spanish energy company now wants to drill an exploratory well early next year in Cuban waters. And as NPR's Greg Allen reports, several other international oil companies are expected to follow.
Repsol is a Spanish company with long experience in deep water drilling. Last year, it successfully sank a well more than 6.5 miles down on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. In 2004, Repsol drilled its first exploratory well off Cuba's northern coast. Now the company says it will drill a second well in the same area early next year. Jorge Piñon is a former Shell and Amoco executive, now a research fellow at Miami's Florida International University. I asked him if Repsol is going back for more, does that mean the oil is there?
Yes, we assume that it is, because a company like Repsol is a company that is not going to go through an exercise like this. Talking about a $45 to $50 million expenditure, if they didn't have a good expectation that there is going to be oil.
Repsol isn't saying much about its plans, other than to confirm that we'll use a deep water rig currently being assembled in China, and that it's partnering in the project with Norwegian and Indian energy companies. Because of the long-standing U.S. trade embargo, U.S. companies are banned from any participation in Cuban oil production, onshore or off. That worries David Guggenheim, and he has nothing to do with the oil industry. He's a marine researcher and senior fellow with the Ocean Foundation. The oil well may be in Cuban waters, he says, but with the loop current and the Gulf Stream, a spill would quickly become a U.S. problem.
The modeling studies that they've performed predict that 90% of an oil spill would end up in U.S. waters, in the Florida Keys and up the east coast of Florida and the U.S. And I think all of this underscores the importance of having a dialogue between the United States and Cuba on this issue.
Next month, a group from the Houston-based International Association of Drilling Contractors is traveling to Havana to discuss best practices, environmental protection, and safety procedures with Cuban officials. Jorge Piñon says through legislation or an executive order, U.S. companies could be allowed to respond to an oil spill in Cuban waters. But it's important those measures be adopted now, before a spill occurs.
So that the oil companies operating in Cuba can pick up the phone and, in short notice, have the equipment, personnel, and other resources necessary in Cuba in order to suppress an oil spill before it hits Key West or South Beach.
Along with Repsol, at least seven other international energy companies have purchased oil leases off Cuba's northern coast, some just 60 miles away from Key West. Piñon says he and others close to the industry are not asking that U.S. companies be allowed to take part in Cuban drilling, just cleanup. But if oil production takes off in Cuban waters, that's likely to change. John Kavulik is senior policy advisor to the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council.
U.S. companies will definitely put pressure on the U.S. Congress and on the White House to, at minimum, allow the oil companies to access information, to have meetings, and if they can't directly contract, perhaps contract as a subcontractor.
That would mean easing the U.S. trade embargo, a touchy subject. And there's another way in which Cuba's new offshore oil production may have a profound impact on the U.S. If a mini drilling boom gets underway in the Atlantic off Cuba and eventually the Bahamas, pressure will build to lift the ban on drilling in U.S. waters near the coast of Florida. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Goal scoring is usually accomplished with skill and tenacity. But in this year's World Cup, some people, particularly goalkeepers, say there's been another factor involved, the ball. The players say the ball being used in this year's World Cup doesn't behave like a traditional soccer ball. And as NPR's Joe Palca reports, physicists say the players are right.
Before we talk about the new ball, let's talk a little about the old one. You may not realize it, but the traditional soccer ball is not really a ball at all. It's an Archimedean solid, or in this particular case,
what the mathematicians refer to as a truncated icosahedron.
That's John Eric Goff. He's a physicist at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics. The truncated icosahedron has 32 panels in pentagonal and hexagonal shapes. But there's no law that says a soccer ball must have 32 panels. Goff says for the last World Cup, Adidas introduced a ball with 14 panels. This year's ball, called the Jabulani, has even fewer.
The Jabulani ball uses 8 thermally bonded panels.
Goff says the number of panels is important.
Balls that have rougher surfaces have different flight dynamics compared to balls with smooth surfaces.
More panels, more seams, more roughness. And oddly, that means the ball goes faster.
What happens is, as the air goes around a sphere, or one of these sports balls, it forms a little layer near the surface of the sphere called the boundary layer.
And a rough surface means the boundary layer breaks down more rapidly when the ball flies through the air.
And what that means is the drag force on the ball, the air resistance, goes down slightly.
The Jabulani has fewer seams, but Adidas has added grooves that roughen its surface. In fact, the Jabulani has less drag, less air resistance than a traditional ball. Goff says two Japanese scientists, Takeshi Asai and Kazuya Seo, used a wind tunnel to show that. Dutch player Giovanni van Bronckhorst learned that empirically in the semifinal match with Uruguay.
Now van Bronckhorst with pace! Oh! It is an absolute firecracker from Giovanni van Bronckhorst! 1-0 Holland!
Van Bronckhorst was about 45 yards from the goal when he struck the ball with his left foot.
It was launched at a little over 70 miles an hour coming off of his boot.
And because it was traveling so fast and the drag was less than on a traditional ball, it stayed higher in the air longer.
Now that particular kick was high up in the right corner of the goal.
Just inches out of the reach of the leaping goalkeeper. But speed isn't the only thing goalkeepers hate about the Jabulani. It knuckles funny. Okay, I'll explain. When you kick a ball, you can make it spin or not spin. If the ball doesn't spin, physicist Rabindra Mehta of NASA's Ames Research Center says it will knuckle or wobble as it flies through the air, making it hard for a goalkeeper to know where it's going.
There is an ideal speed for the maximum knuckling effect. It turns out that for a traditional ball with these 32 panels, that ideal speed was about 30 miles an hour or so.
But with the Jabulani, that ideal speed goes up to nearly 45 miles an hour, and there's still some knuckling at higher speeds, too. For goalkeepers, this is a nightmare. Marcus Hanneman was backup keeper for the U.S. team.
Well, sometimes it goes that way, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down, sometimes it bends, and no one can read it.
Of course, Hahnemann doesn't need to worry about that anymore. Ghana solved his problems by knocking the U.S. out of the tournament. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.